You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today, we're celebrating FQXI's 10th birthday with Anthony Aguirre, and we're discussing the discovery of more than 1,000 new exoplanets and a mission to the stars.
This just went from something that is like of almost pure academic interest, because no one's ever going to do this, to, wow, this, you know, might crash and burn, but this might actually happen.
Testing a rival to quantum theory in the heart of an Italian mountain with Catalina Corziano.
Because we believe that this phenomenon of the measurement and of the collapse of the wave function harbors exactly the secret of the physics of what happens.
And looking at the big picture, as Sean Carroll talks about his research on emergence and his latest book that tackles, well, pretty much everything.
Yeah, so this is a hilariously overly ambitious book, and I'm the first to admit that before anyone else in the audience wants to point it out. The subtitle is On the Origins of Life, Meaning, and the Universe Itself.
He's Brendan Foster.
And she's Zia Morali.
Welcome to an extra special edition of the FQXI podcast, where we're celebrating the 10th birthday of, well, us, the Foundational Questions Institute.
Which means that we're old enough to have developed our own identity, but we're still at that cute stage before moody adolescence, when you have to worry about us taking up smoking, dating, and trying to borrow your car.
Yeah, that's one way of putting it, Brendan. FQXI was launched a decade ago in May 2006 by cosmologists Max Tegmark at MIT and Anthony Aguirre at the University of California, Santa Cruz. We'll be hearing from Aguirre in a moment to find out what their goal was, the ups and downs the Institute has faced, and his favorite research project funded by FQXI.
You know, I've always wondered what the point of FQXI is, so it will be good to finally find out.
Indeed. But before we bring him in, let's take a quick look at some of the recent news in foundational physics. First up, in May, FQXI member Pan Jianwei of the Chinese Academy of Sciences announced that, in July, China plans to launch the world's first quantum communications satellite.
Quantum physicists have already set up ultra-secure communication links here on Earth that exploit quantum quarks to thwart hackers. These use the fact that when you look at a quantum system, you inevitably disrupt it in some way. So quantum communications can be encoded in such a way that if an eavesdropper intercepts them, they will immediately trip an alarm.
Pan was quoted in the Mirror newspaper saying, "The Edward Snowden case has told us that the information in the transmission networks are exposed to risks of being monitored and being attacked by hackers." That was his explanation for the need for a global quantum-secured network.
If the launch goes ahead, it means that China will have won the quantum space race against Europe and the US. So well done. We'll be keeping a watch to see what happens in July, and we will keep you posted.
In other space news, also in May, NASA announced that the Kepler Planet Hunting Telescope had discovered another 1,284 planets orbiting around stars. As reported by Smithsonian, they were able to speed up their hunt thanks to a new statistical analysis technique that helps them quickly identify planetary candidates. And actually, they have another 1,327 candidates up their sleeve that they think are likely to be planets too, but still need to be verified.
Speaking at a press conference, Paul Hertz, director of NASA Headquarters Astrophysics Division, said, "We now know that exoplanets are common and that a reasonable fraction of the stars in our galaxy has potentially habitable planets. Knowing this is the first step toward addressing the question of, are we alone in the universe?"
But how useful is this information? Are we now suffering from planet fatigue, hearing about more and more of these things? Even if they are habitable, how likely are we to actually ever be able to visit them?
Someone who might hope to have an answer is Russian billionaire Yuri Milner. We've talked about his physics initiatives on the podcast in the past. He supports the Breakthrough Prizes, which now dish out more cash per prize than the Nobels, and have honored quite a few of FQXI's own members. Last year, he launched Breakthrough Listen, a SETI project to search for signs of extraterrestrial life. In April, he and Stephen Hawking announced plans to send mini spacecraft to our nearest star system, Alpha Centauri. That's roughly 4 light years away. These nanocraft would be equipped with tiny sails. Lasers shot from Earth would strike the sails, powering the craft onwards. Milner's putting $100 million into the mission for research and development.
Since his announcement, Milner's received some criticism over whether the plan is feasible within the proposed time frame of 40 to 50 years. But then in May, US Congressman John Culberson called for NASA to look into its own mission to Alpha Centauri to launch in 2069, marking the 100th anniversary of the moon landings. This brings up interesting questions about how large-scale projects in foundational physics should be funded. By individuals and charitable foundations, or by governments?
A good person to ask about this, and the Kepler Hall, would be cosmologist and FQXI's director, Anthony Aguirre. Since FQXI is charitably funded and was set up to support projects that might miss out on funding from more traditional sources.
And indeed, I did address those funding issues with Aguirre when I spoke to him earlier. We began by first discussing FQXI's history, development, successes, and challenges. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us. I think this is your first time on the FQXI podcast. That's not good. You should have been on it before.
I can't believe it's been going on for so long and I haven't been here, so I'm happy to make restitution finally.
And speaking of going on for so long, we're celebrating 10 years of FQXI. So I guess my first question is, do you feel old now?
Well, it's interesting. FQX was born at about the same time as my first son. So I've kind of watched both of them grow to age 10 together.
Yeah, which one misbehaves the most?
FQX is far better behaved. It's far better behaved and much less recalcitrant.
I guess we actually haven't talked about this on the podcast at all, so it's time to ask, how did FQXI come about? What's actually the point of it? What's it trying to do?
There was kind of the outward manifested aim of FQX, which was to bring funding and attention and support to these really deep, interesting, big questions, you know, that often got sidelined for various reasons that were unrelated to their validity or interest, sort of sociological or funding or what have you reasons. So we felt like there are a lot of researchers who were in that boat, that they got into physics with these questions in mind, these big, interesting, deep questions about the world. And then they feel like the years go on, they get to think about those questions less and less. The happiest thing that I've seen with FQX is in some sense not the actual research that's come out of it, although that's been super interesting, but is more the feeling of community that I think it's generated between the conferences, the membership, all these individual meetings that happen. I really feel like there's just a more welcoming environment somehow for a certain type of person who really likes to think about these big questions, and that there's less of a demarcation between the topics that you're allowed to think about and the topics that you're not.
When you talk about this sense of community, is it a sense of community that's being fostered between, you know, physicists or other researchers who felt they weren't able to answer these questions and now they can? And now I guess they've got some kind of like self-help group where they can talk about these questions unashamedly with each other. Or is it extending beyond that to, I don't know, the other funders or the university administration or, you know, the people higher up who maybe would have frowned on them perhaps going off in these directions? I mean, you know, how far does that community extend?
You know, I don't think it's sort of like Kleptomaniacs Anonymous, where you get to talk with the other people who are sort of ostracized from society, but you've got your own little niche group. That's not the goal. The goal very much has been to extend the reach of kind of conventional scientific thinking into new territories and keep the quality and keep the rigor, but expand the territory. And I think that has largely happened in the sense, you know, thinking about, say, the multiverse or foundations of quantum mechanics or information theory and thinking about physics through the lens of information. These are all things that when FQX started were pretty fringy. And now there's pretty much a continuum between the sort of mainstream research in physics departments and what the fringiest FQX researchers are thinking about.
Coming down to kind of the particular grants or the particular research areas that have been funded by FQX, can you pick out an area where you think, yes, you know, if we hadn't funded that particular research project, maybe we wouldn't have seen the kind of results that have happened?
Probably my favorite. So I had, you know, every year we have new grad students come in, and there are two grad students who started talking to me who were super interested in shape dynamics.
Oh.
And this is a theory generated by Julian Barber and collaborators like Flavio Mercati that I think it's safe to say simply would not have happened, certainly not have developed in the way that it did without the FQX support. And now, you know, I have actual students who are coming to me interested in working on this thing, and I have to kind of figure out, like, boy, am I going to learn enough about shape dynamics to actually try this? Maybe, because, you know, it's really interesting. So I would say seeing that evolve from kind of there's this kind of interesting guy off doing his own thing, thinking about this Machian interpretation of general relativity, you know, to having grad students come to me and say, this is really cool thing, could we work on this? That, I think, is something that simply wouldn't have happened. And I think there are other instances like that, but that's maybe my favorite because it's particularly clear that without that support, I think it wouldn't have happened.
So I've asked you about all of the, you know, the positive things and the successes, but over the past 10 years, what have been the sort of the challenges or the things where you've had to kind of rethink or say, okay, maybe this isn't working, maybe we should try something else?
FQX has been nicely funded, and we're super grateful to the Templeton Foundation for its continued support. So that has been just wonderful, and working with them has been completely pleasurable and non-problematic, which was a positive surprise. I would say that the less positive thing is that it's, you know, maybe unsurprisingly difficult to find people to give millions of dollars to fund abstract physics research.
I'm going to step away from sort of congratulating ourselves here for a minute and just say, let's just talk quickly while I have you here about what's been happening over the past month or so. And there have been some sort of interesting spacey type things that I'd like your opinion about. One of them is that NASA announced that Kepler had found about 1,000 more exoplanets. And then sort of on a theme with that, Yuri Milner, the internet billionaire who loves physics and keeps, you know, putting money into physics, announced a project to send tiny little spacecraft to Alpha Centauri. Let's just talk about, you know, how exciting are both of these announcements?
It's nice that you've packaged them together there, I think, because there's, on the one hand, just this growing sense that the galaxy is kind of out there full of interesting stuff. Whether it's full of interesting life is a big open question, but it's, I think it does change the psyche a little bit and make you really start to think, okay, suppose we survive the next 100 years of life on Earth or so, you know, and are able to really do some amazing technological things, that galaxy is out there waiting for us. And can we do some thinking about that? And it's funny with the Starshot. So I was giving a class in the fall, and just kind of on a lark, I decided, because I'd been reading about, you know, going to colonizing Mars in the news, I decided, well, let's take a kind of fun problem to provide the core of this class, which is how could we get out and colonize the galaxy? And I kind of quickly worked out that you can't use rockets. There's nothing really plausible in terms of getting big, heavy things out there, but sending little tiny things by accelerating them from some outside mechanism, maybe. And I dug up some old papers, and I thought, wow, this is really hard, but this is not impossible. And I got an undergrad student, and she started doing a little bit of research on it. And then a couple months later, this thing appears in the news, and, you know, it's suddenly the worst undergraduate project ever. from obscurity and fringy, it suddenly became completely mainstream with, you know, hundreds of high-skill PhDs working on it. So her undergraduate project was kind of squashed. Oh. But it was really exciting, you know, because I'd been thinking about it to see, wow, this just went from something that is like of almost pure academic interest because no one's ever going to do this to, wow, this, you know, might crash and burn, but this might actually happen. You know, there's nothing like $100 million to lay a nice foundation for something scientifically.
But I guess, a question that sort of comes to mind, and this then relates back to FQXI, we have these foundations or these philanthropists or, individuals who are putting in huge amounts of money sometimes to promote science research, particularly physics research or foundational physics research. And you spoke at the beginning about how you're trying to fill a gap because that wasn't really something that was being met by funding agencies. But, when people step in to do this, is that taking governments off the hook and saying it's okay, you really don't need to worry about this now because, there are a handful of people who have lots and lots of money, the Mark Zuckerbergs and whatever, and they're going to be taking care of this. So, forget about it. It's being taken care of.
Yeah, I think that's a major problem, really. There has to be something providing the bulk of the money, and that really, I think, has to be the federal government. It's not going to work with a sort of strange composite of powerful individuals doing what interests them. It's great, and I think it's a positive thing, but it simply isn't a replacement. And I think, with all due respect to Yuri Milner, I think the initiatives he's done are very positive. They're very much not the way that, I would have spent the money if it were my money. To have that sort of individual iconoclastic view control all the things that happen in the field of fundamental research would be a big mistake. Society has a huge interest in this, and it should be society and the representatives of society in the form of our government that sort of defines really what the broad brush goals and where the large amounts of money are going.
Should I ask you what you would have done with the money? I assume you wouldn't have just put it all into FQXI, or is that a simple answer? Or would there be, is there something else that you're looking at?
I should say I might have actually funded the Starshot at some lower level, because I really like that one. But I wouldn't have funded it because I wanted to do it. I would have funded it because an organization that I was a part of, like FQX, thought through many different possibilities, weighed them against each other, and decided to do that. So, you said surely you wouldn't give it all to FQX, but a big chunk of it I would have, because I and Max have worked hard to create something that we feel like has been optimized by us to kind of have a large impact in the stuff that we care about. So I couldn't think of a better source personally in my completely biased view.
All right. Well, excellent. Well, thank you very much. And congratulations again. It's been 10 years.
Well, yes, I wanted to thank you for just the spectacular job. I think you brilliantly toil away bringing all this interesting content to the community site and sort of running it largely without much, frankly, effort from the FQX administration, which I think is perfect. And you've done a fantastic job, and I just wanted to commend you for it. And don't you dare cut this out of the interview.
Oh. I was going to, but thank you very much. Thank you. That's really sweet.
That was FQXI's director, Anthony Aguirre, chatting with Zia. The one major thing I took away from that is that Aguirre calls us FQX, and we say FQXI. Should we tell him it's got an I on the end?
Best to just leave it, I think.
It was nice the way that he thanked you for your work with FQXI, Zia. Though I can't help feeling he forgot to mention someone else important.
I know. I thought the same thing. He obviously meant to express his gratitude to our managing director, Kavita Rajana, too.
Yes, that would be well-deserved. But perhaps someone else, someone right here.
I'm teasing you, Brendan. Of course, Anthony Aguirre is grateful to you, too, and would have said so if you'd been the one interviewing him. But if it helps, I shall invite FQXI's other director, Max Tegmark, on, and he can thank you directly.
Oh yes, will that be on the next edition?
Well, I was thinking more along the lines of the 20th anniversary podcast.
Okay, seems fair. We're putting more information about Pan Jianwei's quantum communications satellite announcements, the Kepler Planet Hall, and an interview that Zia conducted with Yuri Milner for Science Magazine, on the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.
I'm also going to be adding a link to a past podcast interview with SETI founder Frank Drake, who spoke to me last year about Milner's search for alien life. There's also links to more about Aguirre's favourite FQXI grant winner, Julian Barber, in case you want to know more about his research. Aguirre's not the only one that loves Barber. I've been putting together a page showcasing the most popular articles, videos, podcast segments, blog posts and essays from FQXI's first 10 years, and Barber features high in almost every category.
He should run for president. And if Aguirre got you interested in FQXI's mission in general, we'll also post a link to the FQXI website on the FQXI website.
Yeah, that seems redundant.
Okay, forget that one. Now we've heard some of the highlights from FQXI's first decade on the planet. But what about the future? In our next items, we're showcasing some of the latest projects we're funding. First up, testing arrival theory to quantum mechanics.
The microscopic world behaves very differently to everyday reality. Particles can be in weird superpositions of being in two or more places at the same time, for instance. That's only until you measure them, though. At that point, reality solidifies and the particle chooses a set location. But how does that happen?
This is called the measurement problem. And standard quantum theory doesn't really have an answer yet. But collapse models developed in the 1980s and 90s modify quantum equations so that bigger objects, made of more and more particles, spontaneously drop out of superposition. Now, quantum physicist and FQXI member Catalina Uanu Curzianu of the National Institute of Nuclear Physics in Frascati, Italy, and her colleagues are carrying out tests to see if this quantum alternative is correct, as Curzianu explained to reporter Karine Picama.
Quantum mechanics describes phenomena in the macroscopic world extremely well, but what we observe in the world of atoms and electrons does not match up with our own visual reality. For instance, while atoms can behave like waves, allowing them to be in more than one place or state at one time, bigger bodies do not show such behavior. So, what happens in between the microscopic and macroscopic worlds? The question of how the myriad of quantum possibilities collapses to the definite state we measure in the lab is such a big question that finding the answer could herald a paradigm shift for quantum physics as a whole. Quantum physicist Catalina Curzianu, who works at the National Institute of Nuclear Physics in Frascati near Rome in Italy, received an $85,000 grant from the Foundational Questions Institute in 2015 to experimentally investigate the collapse we observe when we take measurements of quantum systems. She explains.
When we measure a system, what happens is that we get a very definite answer. So one definite state emerges as an unambiguous event. Then one might ask, how does this wave function collapse and what generates the real events, what we measure or what we see? And the project in the framework of the Foundational Question Institute deals exactly with this and try to answer or to perform an experiment which allows us to get a step closer to the answer to this problem, because we believe that this phenomenon of the measurement and of the collapse of the wave function harbors exactly the secret of the physics of what happens.
The collapse model Curzianu and her colleagues use is called the dynamical reduction model. The beauty of this model is that it modifies the basic Schrödinger equation with additional terms that allow the waveform to collapse in a very natural way, because it allows microscopic systems to remain in superposition while it immediately collapses bigger bodies. What Curzianu measures in these models is radiation.
In our case, what we are doing, it's a measurement of an effect which is called spontaneous radiation emission, which is not present in the standard quantum mechanics. In this case, what we measure actually is this radiation, the spontaneous radiation, which should come out of the interaction of the particles with the field. It's a kind of a field which induces the collapse by the interaction with the particles.
If an electron were to travel through a big space on its own and there was no collapse field present, it would keep going in a straight line and there would be no radiation. Curzianu explains what happens when there is a collapse field.
Due to the interaction with this collapse field, the electron starts to zigzag. And whenever the trajectory changes, it emits radiation. But this radiation in our framework would appear out of the blue. That's why it's called spontaneous. This field which is inducing the collapse of the wave function, in the case of electron or of individual particles, would have the effect that changes the trajectory, if one can say trajectory, you know, the particle-wave duality. Mm-hmm. But however, would change the state of the electron, would interfere with the particle, and would oblige it by the interaction with this field. So on one side, the interaction with the field, it's collapsing the wave function, obliging the electron or the system to choose among different possible solutions. On the other side, this field would be felt by the particles, and these particles in this sense would emit radiation. It's a side effect which we can measure.
So the radiation could be a signature of the existence of a collapsing field, and this is what Curciano hopes to find in her experiments.
We measure the radiation. In this case, radiation would be emitted by the particles present in the detectors themselves and by the surrounding materials. So what we see is an X-ray spectrum, which means energy is much higher than the visible light, but not as high as to enter in the field of gamma rays. So what we try to do is to get a measurement as clean as possible.
Unfortunately, measuring the small radiation signals related to collapse models is not easy because our environment emits huge amounts of radiation too. To reduce environmental radiation, Curciano's experiments take place within the belly of a mountain with instruments made out of ultra-pure germanium. The group is currently in the middle of working out how to reduce the background radiation even further.
We have done a preliminary measurement, a preliminary test measurement. So we are characterizing the detectors and the background. And out of this preliminary measurement, we are now analyzing the data. So we do both data analysis and Monte Carlo simulations to understand what part of what we measure can be ascribed to the residual background, which we know is there. And some very interesting results are coming out, which we hope to publish soon.
Curciano is hoping that they can experimentally get to a point where it is no longer possible to explain the radiation in terms of the background. This might take quantum physicists to a place where they can start to understand the measurement problem and shed light on the conundrum that has been bothering quantum mechanics since its inception, the transition from quantum to classical world. While she is very excited about the prospect of a new physics, she does not think that we will ever know the full truth about how nature works.
I believe that together with many theoreticians that quantum mechanics, what we know today, it's a limit of something else. I hope that somehow soon a glimpse of that theory will show its face in some experiment. So yeah, it might be that we are with quantum mechanics as Newton was with respect to Einstein, but we need an Einstein in this case.
That was Catalina Curciano chatting with reporter Corinne Pickermer. You can read a Q&A with Curciano by Corinne on the website www.fqxi.org/community. We're also posting links to more about collapse models on the podcast page too.
Now, from how the macroscopic emerges from the microscopic to the even bigger picture of how absolutely everything arises. Reporter Sophie Hebden talks to FQXI's Sean Carroll, a cosmologist at Caltech, who talks first about his research looking into how space and time might come out from quantum theory, and then discusses his new book, which makes the case that life, meaning, and the universe itself will one day be completely explained by science.
Sean Carroll is a theoretical physicist based at the California Institute of Technology, working on questions relating to emergence, how the deepest levels of reality are connected to higher levels of behaviour we see in the world around us. He wants to explain the existence of space and time using just quantum physics. His work is addressing the misfit between Einstein's theory of general relativity, which describes space-time as a fabric that bends and stretches according to objects' masses, and quantum physics. I spoke to him via Skype and asked him about the problem he is focusing on.
So, you know, we talk about quantum mechanics a lot. People have a vague idea that it has something to do with probabilities and uncertainty and microscopic physics and atoms and so forth. But really, it's a completely different way of thinking about what the world is. Quantum mechanics replaced classical physics, and classical physics, a la Isaac Newton, says the world is made out of stuff that basically, roughly speaking, has a position and a momentum. So in quantum mechanics, it's not at all like that. We have things called wave functions or quantum states, and they are elements of this big space called Hilbert space. And that's just, we don't need to go into the details, but that's where the wave functions live. And because we are human beings, we tend to think of the world as fundamentally classical, even though we know it's not, because we're professional physicists who do quantum mechanics. So when we construct quantum mechanical theories, we start with some classical theory that could have been true had Newton been right, and then we do what is called quantizing that. So instead of having a position at every moment in time, you have a wave function that tells you the probability that you will see it. So our attitude, my attitude and my students right now, is to sort of not do it that way. We want to start with the quantum mechanical world, with the world as a wave function in Hilbert space. And we want to ask the question, given this kind of wave function we have, given how it behaves, given how it looks when you divide it up in different ways, what does it resemble classically? Could someone just give you a wave function, you look at it and go, oh, I know, that is an electron moving in a three-dimensional space or something like that? Can you derive space and time themselves just from the quantum mechanical wave function? So for us, you know, there's been this set of results in the last 5 or 10 years in quantum gravity that relate the geometry of space-time, which is what Einstein explained to us we interpret as gravity. General relativity says gravity is the curvature of space-time. Relating that to entanglement in a quantum state. Yeah. And increasingly, there's this hint, many interesting hints, that if you have some quantum mechanical system, from the way that different parts of the system are entangled with each other, we can actually infer something like the geometry of space-time itself. So what you and I think of as curved space, gravity, can actually come emerging directly from the entanglement structure of the quantum state of the universe. And if that's true, that's like a very big hint about why the world looks the particular way it does.
So what's entangled in order to produce... So have you got mass entangled in order to produce gravity?
Well, the wonderful thing, and this is what really kind of makes it challenging to think about this, is there is no what. You know, there is no thing. Like when you say, is it mass? Is it particles? Is it fields? For us, all of that is just a relic of the old days when we thought that classical physics was ruling the day. There is nothing but the wave function in our approach. Yeah. So you want to say, well, the wave function of what? And our answer is no. don't ask that. The question is, here's a wave function. What different ways can it look to us? You know, how does it sort of manifest itself in some limit as you look at a lot of it? So some word big classical or semi-classical macroscopic object. So it's not, you know, the entanglement between particles or anything like that. It's an entanglement between different parts of the wave function. And then you ask, what kinds of entanglement are necessary for you to say, I interpret that as a particle moving through space?
Well, what have you achieved so far, and what are you hoping to achieve?
The thing that I'm most excited about right this minute, the paper I'm trying to finish, is we call it deriving space from Hilbert space. So forgetting about gravity for the moment and all the difficulties, let's just start with a wave function and say, like, how many dimensions of space does that wave function live in? Like, the wave function itself is some huge dimensional vector space, but does it look like a particle moving in one dimension or two dimensions or three dimensions? And we have this conjecture that by looking at the mutual information between different parts of the quantum wave function, we can actually reconstruct some underlying geometry to space itself. The mutual information is basically a way of saying how entangled two different parts of Hilbert space really are. And the nice thing about this is you're not relying on any background space-time, no pre-existing structures, no asymptotic boundary conditions. Like, nothing is given to you from outside. You're really just starting from the wave function and getting space out of it. And there's even a hint that if you start with that and then poke it a little bit, you know, perturb the state a little bit, then you get a non-flat geometry, and it looks like it might obey something like Einstein's equations for gravity. There's an enormous amount of work to be done before we can say anything like that with any confidence, but that's the kind of huge ambition that we have in front of us.
Carroll is used to setting his sights big. Not only has he published widely in theoretical physics and cosmology, he is also a hugely successful communicator and relishes bringing physics to the masses. He is known for his blogging, television appearances, TED Talk about the multiverse, which has more than 1.4 million hits, and popular books. His third popular science book, The Big Picture, is published in the US this month. It will be launched in the UK in September. It's an unashamed sales pitch for naturalism, or Carroll's brand of it, called poetic naturalism. He told me what he was aiming for.
Yeah, so this is a hilariously overly ambitious book, and I'm the first to admit that before anyone else in the audience wants to point it out. The subtitle is On the Origins of Life, Meaning, and the Universe Itself. So modesty is not one of the shortcomings of the book. What it's really trying to do is to put things together, to not necessarily to answer every question you might have, but to make the case that every question will be answerable in the framework of science, naturalism. So I do a lot of philosophy in the book, talking about how everyday notions of cause and purpose are perfectly sensible and useful, but they're not fundamentals. They're emergent, just like we were talking about space-time being emergent. Cause and effect is emergent in the macroscopic world. So most of the book, 90% of it, is devoted to that, and then 10% is devoted to saying, and that's okay. You shouldn't feel, you know, existential despair just because we obey the laws of physics. Yeah. And we also don't have any guidance from outside about how to live a good life, but again, that's okay. We have the ability to make choices about how to live a good life, and that's all we ever had and all we really need.
It's a huge book, and Carroll skillfully holds our hands through all 400-plus pages with simple, lucid writing and helpful analogies. But whilst he is polite about other views, unless you agree that physics is all you need for finding meaning in life, you may find some of the more evangelical sections hard-going. The book will join the science versus religion battleground as a kind of manifesto for poetic naturalism. I found the more preachy parts come towards the end of the book, in the caring section, and reading them I felt a strange sort of awkward gap open up, like you've wandered into a self-help group and you're being watched until you conform to what's expected of you. Even so, it's a great read. My personal favourite parts were the forays into history of science through the eyes of lesser-known characters, such as Princess Elizabeth of Bohemia, whose persistent rational lines of questioning influenced Descartes. The whole book exudes Carroll's unique confidence and openness about his worldviews, which to a reserved Brit is rather appealing. When I asked him what he felt were his strongest skills, he responded with characteristic charm.
If you compare me to the best physicist in the world, I'm certainly not the best physicist in the world. You compare me to the best philosophers in the world, I'm not the best philosopher in the world, even the philosopher of physics. But maybe I know more physics than most philosophers, and maybe I know more philosophy than most physicists, and I'm trying to learn more biology and complexity theory to mix that in there also. And I think it all matters. I think that, you know, I can take insights from these different areas and bring them back.
Thanks to Sean Carroll for talking with reporter Sophie Hebden. You'll find a link to his ambitious new book, The Big Picture, on the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. And stay tuned to the community site for an article by Sophie discussing Carroll's work in more depth, coming soon.
That's all we have time for in this edition. Thank you once again to Anthony Aguirre, Catalina Curzianu, Karin Pikama, Sean Carroll, and Sophie Hebden.
As usual, you can reach us by email at podcast@fqxi.org or on Twitter at FQXI.
She's been Zia Morali.
And he's been Brendan Foster. I'm off to shoot nano-sized pieces of FQXI's 10th birthday cake towards Alpha Centauri.
And I'm going to hide in a mountain in Italy and spontaneously decay.